Welcome to the Rational Faiths Podcast. I'm Brian Kissel.
And I'm Brian Dillman.
And for those who have never listened to the podcast before or have never listened to Rational Faiths, it is a Mormon-based blog and podcast seeking to provide a safe, fair, and balanced space for people to discuss the complexities, difficulties, and the beauty of our Mormon tradition.
And in an entertaining and informal way, we are dedicated to exploring the vital, applicable, and expansive topics that we are all wrestling with as Mormons, while simultaneously keeping Mormonism weird.
Absolutely. And today we're going to be talking a little bit about apologetics. And I was kind of thinking about apologetics and Mormon studies and in general. But Brian, when did you start kind of getting involved with this kind of crazy online internet Mormonism, Mormon studies kind of world?
Maybe a year and a half ago, just starting to become aware of what's all out there, Sunstone, the different journals, the different blogs, all the different books that are published by these small publishers. About a year and a half ago.
Absolutely. I think it's fascinating. I started learning about it maybe like 5 or 6 years ago, but I think it's so interesting how this like entire world could exist. And Like my whole life, I had no idea that it was even there. But for me, it was so fascinating, kind of this freedom because we all kind of have this interest in learning more about Mormonism and trying to kind of come to better understandings of differing things. It feels like it's kind of more open for everybody to be able to jump in. It's not just the scholars who can take some of these questions and studies, but all of us can kind of investigate these questions we have.
Yeah, there's all kinds of people that are in there. There's people like Michael Quinn and others that are formally trained as historians, and then there's others that jump in even late in life, like Greg Prince and Lester Bush are examples that were
Brian Hales too. Yeah.
They were actually, and Brian Hales. There's three that were in the medical profession, and then they jumped in and did some serious historical work as well. So all kinds of people are in there.
Yeah. And what we're going to be doing today we're going to be sharing an interview that I did with Nancy Phippen Brown, who is one of these individuals who was a journalist during her career, but later on in life, she decided to start studying some of these different topics and jumping into it a little more. And thus we talk a little bit about that. Yeah, so let's just go ahead and jump right into the interview. Today I have the wonderful opportunity to be speaking with Nancy Phippen Brown, who is the author of Help Thou Mine Unbelief. Nancy, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
So let's go ahead and give a little bit of an introduction to yourself. Were you born and raised in the church? Just go ahead and tell a little bit about your history to give an idea of who you are as we're later talking about your book.
Okay. Yes, I was born and raised in the church. I'm a lifer, as they as they say. And I, you know, came from a family of 6 children, and my parents were married for 64 years, married in the temple. And I had a wonderful childhood, a wonderful background, and was very active in the church. I kind of, you know, I got into journalism. I've always enjoyed writing, and so I went to school and got my degree in journalism. I've been told that it's kind of a mutt degree because I went to 5 different universities before I actually graduated.
Yeah.
and was raising my children at the time, so it was quite a feat, I thought, to do it that way. But as a result, had a nice career while raising my children, working as a reporter and editor for various newspapers and magazines across the country, and spent a year even at the Church News at one point and really enjoyed that opportunity. I served a full-time mission in Colorado, and just basically have been actively serving in wards and stake callings throughout my life, and have just been a good, strong member of the church. However, I have to say that there was a time when I was inactive during my youth and early 20s. And during that time, a lot of different questions and doubts arose. But I got through all that and managed to continue on with my church career, as they say.
And if you don't mind, like what were some of those concerns and doubts as a young adult that were concerning you?
Probably a lot of it was just wanting the freedom to do what I wanted, you know.
You're right.
Feeling that the church had constraints on that sort of thing. Just kind of a little streak of wanting some independence out there. But along the way, I've always had a desire to know God, to find out if he's actually real. And so during that period of inactivity, I found myself going to a lot of different organizations and religions searching for God. And, you know, I'm nearly 62 years old, so a lot of this was happening during, the 60s and 70s, and I got involved in Scientology and mind dynamic organizations, you know, astral projection, this sort of thing, because I was always had this spiritual element to my psyche that was always looking for God and tried to find him in all kinds of places and never really found him there. So I ended up coming back to the church where I was raised and found a lot of the answers about that, right, within the confines of, where I was raised, and found a lot of answers to questions that I'd had with regard to that. So anyway, even though I went back to the church and have stayed active in it my whole life, I've always still, had some doubts about God. I never really had doubts about some of the historicity of the church and some of the problems that are brought up by church critics and so forth today. But I still had other questions about the reality of God. So it wasn't until my father passed away about 2 years ago, and I saw how it affected my mother, who had always been strong in the church for her whole life and raised all of us to be. She began to express feelings of doubt about God and an afterlife and was desperate in her fears that she would never see my dad again. She was pained by the fact that he never even came to see her beyond the veil, like she'd heard happening to a lot of other people. So I tried to help her. I tried to sit down and show evidence that God really existed, but I found that I was sorely lacking in my ability to help her. So I began to dig. I wanted to know, too, would I see my father again? So I spent hours daily and way into the night researching what scientists and scholars had to say and compared their findings with the words of the prophets, apostles, and LDS educators. And the result of all that research, which took me about a year, is this book. And I'm just hoping that it helped me, it helped my mother. Both of us are, just don't have those doubts anymore, and we feel a strong connection with our Father in heaven. And I just want others to maybe feel some of what this book has helped us to feel.
Very interesting. Yeah, because as I was telling you as well before we recorded, for me, that's one of the most fascinating topics and questions. Like I'm really into a lot of the different apologetics and a lot of the different topics. I'm fascinated by the historical issues and complexities that I was frankly unaware of before going through kind of a faith transition. But to me, it those historical difficulties also have never really been that big of a problem for me. What's been a big problem or a concern or what I've thought the most about are these specific questions about whether God actually exists. So that's why I thought that those are some of your concerns. I think that's wonderful. Or the topics that you discuss. If it's okay with you, I think it would be great to maybe jump in and talk a little bit about your book. So what exactly is it? What do you cover within it? It's called Help Thou Mine Unbelief.
Yeah. Well, This book, the subtitle of the book, is maybe a little more telling. It says, Scientific, Historical, and Spiritual Evidence of God. What I was trying to do is find tangible, meat-on-the-bone evidence of God's existence as it comes from an LDS perspective, because I also wanted, in the process, to show that the restored gospel is also true. So what I did is I tried to take science, history, and the actual spiritual experiences of other people and combine them all into this one setting that shows evidence that these things are true. Prophets have told us from the beginning that there is no conflict in putting science and scholarship right alongside revelation and spirituality in our efforts to establish truth, and that reason and scholarship can help clear the air, so to speak, fill the gaps, provide clarity, and ultimately illuminate truth. So that's what I wanted to do. A lot of us just don't have the kind of spiritual faith just through prayer and church attendance and scripture reading that a lot of other people have. Sometimes we need something more tangible to go along with that. Elder Maxwell said, and this is a quote, rational argument does not create belief, but it maintains a climate in which belief may flourish. And that's the whole premise behind this. I have found through my research that both science and religion always end up sourcing God as like the master chemist, physicist, astronomer, biologist, and even artist. They all come to that same conclusion. And I also found that a lot of scientists really themselves hold a strong belief in God. Of course, many don't. Because they're wrapped up in just obtaining empirical evidence for things. But they don't really realize that man is a dual being. And so there's the physical as well as spiritual, and combined together, that's where true evidence lies. While empirical proof of God is still lacking out there in the world of science and scholarship, we do have a preponderance of evidence that he's real. Do you want me to go into a little bit of those evidences?
Yeah, definitely. That's what I was going to say.
Yeah, there's a lot of it, and I tried to include it. And believe me, I'm no scholar or scientist, so everything I put in there is pretty much in layman's terms. If I can understand it, anybody can. But just to go through a few of these, there are some like 15,000 galaxies, many of them 13 billion years old, stretching billions of light years across the universe. I believe, and science seems to point, that the Big Bang theory is more than just a theory anymore. It's a viable explanation as long as we put God at the helm. There's a difference between just talking about it flat out and saying that God was the designer and that he used the Big Bang to accomplish the creation. A lot of people, a lot of good LDS people believe that, but think somehow it's not in keeping with what the church teaches. But there is no doctrine on that. So I also look at how the Earth is the perfect distance from the sun to support life. Gravity holds a thin layer of mostly nitrogen and oxygen, just a mere 50 miles above the Earth. If the Earth was any smaller or bigger, that would not be possible. You look at the miraculous properties and processes of water to sustain life. It's incredible. The elaborate process of photosynthesis screams that there must be a divine creator in all this. Anyway, I go through lots of things. One of them also being quantum mechanics has discovered that the universe is actually part of a multiverse. Not just a single universe, but it's part of a multiverse. And this coincides completely with the law of eternal progression. So we talk about that. Okay, how God uses the brain to communicate through dreams and visions. That's all stark evidence of his existence. Near-death experiences and after-death communications beyond the veil are also very convincing. So this is just, you know, the book goes into all kinds of things, but as far as just flat out evidences of his existence, these to me are very stark. For me personally, I would say that the topic of near-death experiences is probably my favorite. This is where people who literally have died for a small amount of time, they miraculously are resuscitated. And during that time, they have basically report leaving their bodies, and they observe what's happening around them. Or they actually travel. You know, this is where they actually... Okay, sorry, back it up. They observe what's happening around them, and they also travel into the spirit world. And as I've researched this, and I've included all kinds of stories of people's actual experiences, it appears that 20% of the world's population from every corner of the world have NDEs, as they call them, near-death experiences. And there's organizations that are dedicated toward cataloging and telling these stories. So it's mind-boggling, the kind of things that are out there. Researchers have shown that very young children have near-death experiences. Blind people who have been blind from birth suddenly can describe what they're seeing during this experience, and they've never ever had vision before. Even atheists, people who don't believe in God at all, report having near-death experiences. So, and all of the elements in these experiences coincide completely with LDS beliefs. Anyway, that's one of the ones I really enjoy.
Very interesting. I like taking a lot of these different scientific concepts and ideas that scientists have looked into and just kind of thinking about ways that they can apply to us. But I guess for me, sometimes we can be a little aggressive in saying, well, this means this particular thing. Because like I'm sure you would acknowledge, like in the near-death experiences and things, I mean, there are lots of complexities with that as well. Like to me, I would think that that's still kind of just a biological reaction that's occurring within ourselves, and versus this is evidence that we are like a dualist argument or thing. So I guess what I'm saying is I think there are points on both sides, but to be able to look at the evidence and say, hey, this is my perspective versus saying this is absolutely what's going on. Cause I think a lot of scientists would argue with certain interpretations. Does that make any sense?
Oh, absolutely. And that is the argument. And I try to address that in the chapter I write on near-death experiences and out-of-body experiences. I try to go through what a lot of science disbelievers, I guess, in this whole concept bring out as why it is just a reaction in the body. It's just some kind of a neurological change that goes on when people approach death or die. And I try to address all of those arguments and show that, well, you know, you can go that route and you can think that, but some of the evidence I've uncovered says otherwise. And so I've tried to address that. For instance, the experiences, the examples that people give are kind of hard to deny. For example, I'm going to read this out of the book. A woman with a heart condition was dying at the same time her sister was in a diabetic coma in another part of the same hospital. The woman reported having a conversation with her sister as both of them hovered near the ceiling, watching the medical team work on her body below. When the woman awoke, she told the doctor that her sister had died while her own resuscitation was taking place. The doctor denied it, but when she insisted, he had a nurse check on it. The sister had, in fact, died during the time in question. That's just one example. There's so many that just can't be explained. But this is just, you know, I don't want to get too involved in just this one thing.
No, sure.
It's just one that I find very fascinating and I find is evidence that there is an afterlife, that people are visiting the spirit world, even general authorities. I include stories from some of them where they have had those experiences. People in China, people, you know, all over have these. And so for me, I find that to be very compelling. But like I say, the book is filled with lots of things that I think I've had questions about, and I assume others, if I do, and I'm just a normal everyday LDS member, I assume other people do as well. So beyond that, the book also discusses how so many religions came to be. I've always wondered about that. It examines their similarities and shows that each can be traced back to the very same beginnings. Adam and Eve, the book of Genesis, everything about it, everybody can be traced back to that. I found that very compelling. It covers symbolism in both scripture and the temple and shows how scholars have traced these rites back in history to lend credence to the ancient rituals still in effect today. I never understood much of the temple endowment because I didn't understand the symbolism. But discovering that all of it can be found in ancient records throughout much of the world just kind of sheds a whole new light on it for me. So I go into that. I go into the Christ myth. A lot of people don't believe Christ was even existed, let alone is who he said he was. And so we right. examine that through history. Anyway, just a few of the things that it goes into.
Do you want to talk in any more detail about some of the different topics of the book before we go on?
Yeah, let me discuss one more that I think is important too. I always had trouble with the figurative versus literal nature of scripture. And I just I just couldn't believe that all of it was literal. Some people have a difficult time with feeling that they need to accept many of the stories in the Bible literally, such as Noah and the flood or the Tower of Babel or even the Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden story. And we're not good Mormons unless we accept these things as literal. But even church leaders have agreed that many aspects of these stories are figurative or allegorical. So what I try to bring out is that there's room in Mormonism for a figurative interpretation of these stories, at least in part. So, for example, take Noah. That one was so hard for me to accept as literal, and it seemed like all the Sunday school lessons and talks about it made it sound as if it was. But as I investigated this topic, what I discovered is that common to all ancient texts is that Bibles is what Bible scholars have called etiological legends, which are stories and myths used to explain two things. One, how something came to be, or to teach some kind of moral teaching. These etiological legends are always what I found to be rich in symbolism, exaggerations of a real event, and often include kind of sketchy details and understandings of the actual facts. It's also true that ancient societies and their prophets wrote down their stories according to their own understanding of the world around them. So with this in mind, many scholars believe the flood, while real, was actually limited to a local area rather than covering the whole planet. Understanding the meaning of certain Hebrew words, which I found really interesting, bears this out and also indicates that Noah most likely took two of every domesticated animal and fowl to be used for food and clothing during their time on the ark, rather than literally every living creature, including carnivores, which I had a hard time understanding. So that's just one element. I go into a few that suggest that, these are true stories, but maybe they're not as literal as, we tend to think.
Yeah, and I really like that. And not only, I think, are there some of these different interpretations that we have that may not be, that can be kind of cultural and things, but I think sometimes we'd be surprised by what our actual expectations are. For example, Joseph Fielding Smith, I think a lot in the more, kind of in the world of internet Mormonism and liberal Mormonism and things. When we're talking about Joseph Fielding Smith, he's kind of the dogmatic guy, and
has, right.
But it's like even when you look into some of his teachings, I mean, he had a lot of teachings as well that would even
point in some of these directions. Like here's a quote I found from him where he says, "Even the most devout and sincere believers in the Bible realize that it is, like most any other book, filled with metaphor, simile, allegory, and parable, which no intelligent person could be compelled to accept in a literal sense." You know, and I was
great
really
quote.
Yeah, and I was really interested by that quote because I had always had this understanding of him that I wouldn't have thought he would have shared that. And I think that occurs really often where we think we have all of the answers. We think we know, even just taking guesses of what the church or the general authorities believe. Like, hopefully we can talk about this in a second, of like, as you said, evolution and some of these things that we think we know what the official policy or official views, and I would add in like the Mormons and Gays website and some of these other things where we think we know, but if you actually look into it, there's more complexity and breadth and responses that may surprise us.
Absolutely. I'd like to talk about that a little more too, but you're right. That quote from Joseph Fielding Smith is a really good one, and I tried to include lots of quotes like that from the brethren throughout the years on this whole idea of literalness versus figurativeness. It's interesting, just to throw this in as an aside, as I've been trying to get the word out about this book, I ended up talking to a publisher who, online. I guess he was kind of had a bookstore online or something. I don't know what it was. And I was talking to him and sent him a copy to see, you know, if he'd be interested. And he writes me back and he said, "I love everything." He said, "I love 90% of your book." He said, "But that one 10% is, I can't use the book because of that one 10%. And I said, "Well, that's fine, but tell me what that is." And the whole thing was about evolution. And he just could not. He was a literalist, with a Mormon literalist, and I think we kind of can almost put us all in two camps a little bit. Maybe that's too general, but you know, those who are literalists in their whole thinking about Mormon doctrine and even Mormon culture, and those who are not, who have a more open-minded viewpoint of other possibilities. And so anyway, I just thought that was interesting that out of all of it, that was one he just couldn't take on. And, you know.
Oh, sorry. And I was going to say, yeah, going back to that, it's those expectations. Like a story that I have that I tell all the time because it was really influential on myself. When I was about like 16, you know, I had never really considered a lot of these different things. I wasn't really a very thoughtful kid, but we were in a museum and we were looking at like different dinosaur bones and I was trying to figure out what I thought about that. So I was asking my friends in the ward, and then I was asking lots of different people, "Well, what do you believe about the dinosaurs and about evolution and the age of the earth?" And I didn't really, like one thing I think is interesting is most of the responses that I got were people didn't really have, I think most people weren't really thinking about it and didn't really have like, "Oh, this is why I think evolution is wrong," or "This is why." It was just kind of this gut thing. But even, and as I started kind of looking into it and talking more, I ended up talking to a scout leader who was very careful and kind in the way that he did it, but he was like, "Well, there are lots of different perspectives, and let's look at these scriptures, and let's look at this, and maybe evolution and the Big Bang, maybe these could be things that could, maybe the ways that God created the earth." And he's like, "Pray about that. Like think about the evidence. You don't have to just ignore it. You can ponder it." And I thought about that, and that was really powerful for me. And then later my mother found out that this scout leader had been teaching me evolution. And again, it was without looking at this evidence that, or looking at this perspective that had been given, but it was just this gut thing that she was very upset and didn't even really know what we had been talking about. It was just evolution was involved and
yeah,
this scout leader's teaching me about it, you know? And it was, and like she has a very different perspective now, but it's like,
I think that cultural understanding, again, of what we think we know, because it, as you hinted, I mean, the church, the official church position, which was shocking to me again when I found out, is that there isn't a position on evolution. Like, I have another quote where David O. McKay was saying that it's just his opinion, you know, it's not a true, that when he was talking about man, his origin and his destiny, and then also the church's official position, which is that there isn't really a position. So again, I guess I'm just trying to say and focus on that idea again, that I think sometimes our expectations that we know every single answer to every single question can be a little bit problematic. And it's okay if people, in my opinion, even as somebody who considers himself to be a scientist or working on being a scientist, I'm okay with people not necessarily taking the evidence seriously or even at least going this different route of not believing in evolution. But I do think that expectation that we know all of the answers is problematic.
Absolutely. I love the way your scout leader approached it for you. I had a similar experience as a teenager in young women. And, you know, the talk at the time outside the church, just everywhere, was whether there's life on other planets. And so I thought, well, you know, I wonder. I didn't know what the church felt. And so I was talking to one of my leaders, and I said, do you believe in that there's life on other planets? And she said, oh, absolutely there is. And I was shocked. I think my jaw hit the ground that our church would actually believe in such an out there kind of a thing. And but of course, you know, we talked about it and realized that God has created many worlds, and his children have been sent to many worlds and so forth. So bringing it into context, you know, and it made sense. But you know, before I was thinking that the church then believed in little green men, you know, on Mars and stuff. So, but you know, just a little understanding can go a long way.
And at the time when those conversations were going on, were people bringing up like Brigham Young quotes and stuff? Like, Brigham Young was talking about that. Or were people using that as evidence? Or?
Well, yeah, I think so. You know, as I recall, you're taking me back a long way. But that was the one thing that really stood out, you know, for me at the time.
One of the things that I think is most fascinating about studying apologetics or defending the faith, right? That's what apologetics are. Is kind of the way that we will do that, you know, and kind of as is illustrated in some of these things. I think sometimes there can be this aggressive move to kind of stomp out dissent or some of these different questions, while there are other kind of perspectives. So I'd like to kind of hear some of your thoughts. What are some of the better ways that we can be defending the faith?
Okay, well, I've got to say that I love how various groups and individuals have rallied over the years to stand up to the church's critics and defend the faith. There was a time when, and this could be wrong, but my perception was almost that the church kind of buried its head in the sand, you know, and just didn't want to deal with any of that. And and I think rightfully their role is to be a special, the apostles and prophets are to be a special witnesses for Christ. And you can kind of go far afield by getting too much into this. So I really love the fact that there are apologetic organizations and groups. The information they share is invaluable to people who sincerely question and want to find answers to strengthen their beliefs. But I think there's another area of apologetics in which we as members of the church should engage, and that is in supporting each other when the pain of unbelief and just questions create the kind of heartache and feeling of ostracism that a lot of people feel within the LDS community. You know, if I have a little different take on things, if I want to raise my hand in Sunday school and maybe supply a different answer that's a little outside the box, I want to be able to do that without all the looks and the stares and the, telling me I'm wrong, you know. And I say me, meaning anybody in general. Sometimes members learn of faulty or misleading interpretations about some aspect of the church on the internet and elsewhere from other people, and it destroys them. They hear one disparaging charge and they accept it as fact and choose not to study it out further through the church avenues and apologetics avenues. And they end up leaving altogether, or they just let unresolved concerns haunt them for the rest of their lives. That's kind of what I did. You know, I've gone through, I've been active my whole life, but I had some unresolved concerns about God. So I kind of got exposed to apologetics just through the process of writing this book. I had no idea there was so much out there. So I just encourage people, when they get exposed to some of these things and they go through this paradigm shift, that number one, they don't just let it take over, that they go and they try to find answers because they're out there, answers that make sense, and also allow the Holy Ghost to bear witness of that truth. But if they just accept it and move away from it, just leave the church, they're missing out on some great answers. So the rest of the members of the church need to allow space for that growth to take place without jumping on people and making them feel like they're on the outside looking in. So that part I feel strongly about. Now, your question about what then we can do to defend the faith without being so, what's the right word, militant,
militant or aggressive, and kind of jumping in with what you were saying as well, because I think that is, in doing apologetics, where you are trying to look at these different issues and trying to come up with different interpretations or ways. Because I think often what the problem is that people are being confronted with information that they have never seen before. And what's the most problematic things are not the things that are like the Ed Deckers or some of right. these different information where you look it up and it's like, oh, well, that's not... Where people are using things that aren't very don't have evidence for them. The things that are really difficult are, for example, growing up in the church, always going to institute and studying as much as you can, trying to read all of the church books, and then being maybe 25 or whatever, or even my dad, who was 40 years old, never knew that Joseph Smith practiced polygamy or never knew about that evidence.
Right.
I think that those are the kinds of things that are very painful, at least in my experience, where it's not necessarily these lies that people are always talking about, but it's finding out, it's like this feeling of betrayal, right? And then when apologists are coming out and trying to deal with the real history or deal with some of these different issues, then they can even be backlashed against because members don't know about it. So they're obviously just trying to stir up trouble or you're trying to spread evolution, you know?
Right.
So maybe respond to that or share any thoughts about that.
I think it's can be very damaging and challenging when we're on the internet looking up something for our Sunday school lesson and suddenly you see all this other stuff that you didn't know. And it really does just affect you in such an adverse way. And I think it just really is what you do with it that matters. You touched on one of the things that we have to remember is that there really isn't a lot of church doctrine, specified church doctrine for everything that comes up. And unless it is really actual doctrine as stated in the standard works or a bona fide revelation addressed as such by the prophet, we're really free to believe what we want to if it's going to help increase our faith. And that includes these kind of topics, like evolution or whatever. We're told that we need to work at our own salvation and get individual witnesses of truth for ourselves. That tells me that there's room for a variety of interpretations where doctrine is not stated as such. if you get exposed to some thing like Joseph Smith practiced polygamy, or the controversy over the Book of Abraham, whatever it might be, or that there were no horses in the ancient Americas, there are answers to those things, is what I'm saying. And that's what I love about apologetics. I'm going to put a small plug in here for Michael Ashe's book, Shaken Faith Syndrome. That really answers so many things in a context that makes sense. Sometimes if you don't understand why there's a particular fact, a negative, seemingly negative fact about church history and our church history, and you don't understand the context or the other information that helps you to understand why it took place or whatever, then it does on its face sound awful, and it can shake you to the very core. So you've got to go after those answers. You can't just sit and think that, you know, that just the fact itself is true in and of itself. There may be more information you need to have. The other thing I wanted to point out is that there are many myths and misconceptions within the church that often members as a culture interpret to be doctrine. You know, stuff like the Big Bang and evolution. Joseph Fielding Smith and Bruce R. McConkie, the books that they wrote back in the 50s, were very literalist in discussing those topics. And so most members of the church thought that that was doctrine. And that's when, as you mentioned, David O. McKay had to come out and say, no, those are just the opinions of the authors. They are not actual doctrines of the church. And he even stated himself, and I include this in the book, that there's many parts of evolution that seem to make some sense. That's my paraphrase, but basically what he said.
Yeah, and yet still, is it just a marketing problem or something? Because it's like, still to this day, lots of people still have that kind of expectation that Mormon doctrine and Joseph Fielding Smith's book on evolution that's like the official church stuff.
Yeah. In fact, I have to admit, that's kind of what I thought until I started researching this book. And I was one of them. I was a child, a product of the 50s, and I just kind of grew up thinking that that was the case. But in any event, there are a lot of myths. For instance, one would be the Word of Wisdom includes all caffeinated drinks, such as soda, but it only states alcohol, coffee, and tea. And we've all assumed that the coffee and tea is because of the caffeine, so therefore that's why no soda. But, you know, that has started changing, too, over the years. But it's a myth. Another is that good Mormons should be Republican. You know, there's no room for Democrats or anything else. A good Mormon doesn't practice birth control. Good Mormons should not oppose the church in political issues of any kind. Another myth is that the prophet and the apostles are infallible. But that's just not true. They have opinions like everybody else. And unless it's revelation directly from God, that's what it is, you know, opinion. I still think we should listen to their counsel and so forth, because they are who they are and they're very righteous people. But not necessarily doctrine is coming out of everything they say. Another myth, mental illness is a sin. A lot of people in the church look at that. If you're active, you'll be less likely to have an addiction to pornography. And also specific ways to keep the Sabbath day holy. A lot of people think it's very cut and dry, but it's not. There's room in this church for varying ideas if it's not official church doctrine. And we need to rid ourselves of all judgment of each other. It is not our place. And I don't care what the topic is, it is not our place to judge. Even in doctrinal matters, we're all at varying degrees of testimony, and so need space within the culture of our church to be allowed to grow. And we can help each other grow. We need to understand and support someone who bravely offers a differing opinion in Sunday school rather than to point out the fallacy of their thinking. We need to welcome open discussion because it creates an atmosphere that welcomes instead of polarizes.
Absolutely. And it's difficult because, I mean, there's so many different things going on. I mean, it makes you uncomfortable when people are, I mean, that's a natural psychological thing that when you're hearing an opinion that you've never heard before, you feel a little bit uncomfortable, especially if it's conflicting with your prior ideas. But again, going back to this discussion about apologetics and the best way for us to defend the faith, I strongly believe that it's like, because for me, when I was struggling and when I was going through the biggest parts of my faith crisis or faith transition, again, it wasn't necessarily these specific details. It's the way that we treat each other, you know.
Yeah.
And when you can have somebody who is struggling and who can't figure out ways to make the church work, and then you have people responding in these ways that are defensive, and they make sense, and they're not bad people trying to do it, but where people are like, oh, well, then why don't you just leave? Why don't you just get out of here if it doesn't make sense to you, or if you don't like this?
Yeah.
You know, and it's like we need to be kind. We need to recognize that these issues and like, for example, going back to the learning about Joseph Smith, that he was a polygamist, for example, when you're a little bit older, like I don't think the answer is, well, why didn't you know that? That's your fault. You know, it's like, that is painful. And that is something that, like just the fact that you're there and you, this is something that you feel should have been taught to you, or whatever the different difficult issue is, there is real pain going on. And I love a statement by Phil McLemore where he talks about, he has a mantra where he says, anger is a sign of hurt and pain. Nurture them. You know, I think that's a really important thing for us to remember whenever we're talking about these difficult issues or talking about people who are struggling with their faith. We need to recognize that this is a painful moment, and we need to be kind. You know,
absolutely. And you know, along with that, I'd like to just say a few words about Doubting Thomas, if that's okay.
Yes, go ahead.
The last chapter in my book is entitled Help for the Doubting Thomas, and I try to provide some things that people can do to help them in the times that they have doubt. But I think that Thomas basically has gotten a bum rap over the centuries for not believing that Christ had risen because he hadn't seen him when he appeared for the first time to the other apostles. The title Doubting Thomas makes it seem like we are weak, deficient, or sometimes even rebellious if we, like him, have doubts. The Savior himself acknowledged Thomas's need to know, and he didn't reject him for it. He lovingly gave him what he needed so he could believe. He will do the same for us because he understands our need to know. That's what it's all about. We're here to learn and grow and increase our knowledge of him and of our Father in heaven. So he's going to give us what we need to know. The thing we need to remember about this doubting disciple, Thomas, is that he stuck around. Despite the misgivings that he had faith sufficient, just enough, to wait to see if Jesus would come back. Like so many who doubt, Thomas wanted to believe, and so he lingered for 8 days, unwilling to give up until he knew for himself that Jesus had risen. And Christ was so loving in his response to Thomas when he did appear and said, "Don't doubt anymore, I'm here." And that made all the difference. If we help each other with love and acceptance not to give up, then we are being true disciples of Jesus Christ. And I also want to say that even though, you know, the book has a lot of science and history and explanations of a physical nature, it's also peppered with the spiritual experiences of others as they relate to these various topics. And I want people to know that I understand, just because, you know, some of us need that little more meat on the bone of tangible evidence of God and of the restored gospel, that ultimately our testimonies have to come through the Holy Ghost, that our connection with God, if we want to commune with Him and have that kind of relationship with Him that we all seek, it really does come right back down to faith and a witness of the Holy Ghost. What I've done is tried to couple the two together in this book so that it can just strengthen us that much more. And I hope that people will pick it up and pass it on if it helps them and to increase their faith and their belief. And it was a privilege for me to go through this undertaking and take this journey. And I hope that it will help others as well.
That is beautiful. And I think that's a good place for us to go ahead and end. Real quick, where can people find your book?
It is on Amazon.com as well as BarnesandNoble.com. It is also right now in all the Siegel bookstores. The distributor of my book is in the process. It's new, and so he's trying to get it into other bookstores as well. There's lots of mom and pop LDS bookstores around the country and the world. And so, but right now it is in Siegel. I know that for sure. And I hope they can check it out.
Wonderful. And I'll go ahead and put a link to your book in our show notes so the audience can find it there. So Nancy, thank you so much for coming on to the Rational Faiths podcast.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a real privilege. I enjoyed it.
Wonderful. So Brian, what did you think of the interview? What are some of your thoughts or highlights or some points that you'd bring up?
Well, I think it's neat that anybody who feels so inclined can get into apologetics or critical work or whatever. So I found that really cool that she just wanted to learn more or wanted to contribute, I guess, more in helping people regain or retain their faith. And so she jumped right in there. And I also found that at one point she mentioned that before she started studying and preparing for this book, she was unaware of the complexity of the issues that are hanging on to the Mormon narrative. And, you know, that goes to show that there's a whole lot of work to be done. There's a whole lot to be learned. And she's just another example of that.
Absolutely. And I loved it. See, I think there can kind of be some of these stereotypes that we as members of the church can be just so close-minded and not willing to kind of look at those things. But I think there are a lot of great examples of people once they come to these different things. We're I think most of us are really just trying to struggle with these different questions and trying to better understand them. And that's like with Nancy, she's trying to take kind of a scientific approach. And as somebody who's intending on going in that direction of becoming a scientist, and I take a lot of these things really seriously. And thus I come to some different conclusions than she does. But I just love that she is trying to take science seriously and trying to wrestle with these different questions. And I think that she provides something that is very valuable and interesting for those who are kind of looking into some of these questions.
Yeah. And I think some people will find the answers that she provides useful and others might not, but I think she's doing a great job in contributing and providing at least one more pathway that someone might be able to take based on her interpretations and her assessment of the evidence and the conclusions that she comes to.
Wonderful. So thank you so much for listening. As always, we would strongly appreciate that you go and find or subscribe to the podcast so that you can see when the new episodes are coming out. And please consider giving us a review in iTunes and Stitcher. And I also wanted to say that last night I did a recording with Michael Barker and Melody Nui, and we were talking about the Meet the Mormons film that has recently been released. So we have done this review, and we're going to be publishing it fairly soon. So watch for that.
So real quick, 3 stars, 5 stars. Oh,
so many stars. You can't even imagine. We can't spoil that. You'll have to listen to the episode.
Okay. I'll wait and listen. Sounds good.
Wonderful. So thank you so much for listening.
All right. Good night, listeners.